I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Matthews.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish. Yeah.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another episode of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a very special guest lined up for you. We're catching up with an old friend of the show, and that is David Mitchell, who is a brand consultant. And he's going to be talking to us about how the Perth Glory here in the A-League in Australia can get back to great heights in terms of engaging the public and becoming a successful club. He's also going to touch on F1 because he has plenty of experience in that field, and I think you'll find some of what he has to say on that very, very interesting. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
John, good to be back for our 551st show.
And you've been doing a bit of travelling.
Oh, a little bit, yeah. I just skipped across to Barcelona.
Any particular reason?
blow
your horn.
Well, no, our boxing film was in the Barcelona Sports Film Festival, which is one of the sort of most regarded in the world. And I have to say, very privileged that we were selected as the best documentary. And when you consider they'd had over 3,000 entries.
Whoa.
It suddenly, I only found that out after the awards ceremony when one of the judges told me that. And you just suddenly, that's very humbling.
Fantastic effort. Well done. Great achievement.
Thanks very much.
About time.
Yeah, it's nice.
You keep pumping them out, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're starting filming the new one, and I'm still looking for any sponsors if anyone wants to come on board. But we're starting filming the new one in May this year.
Excellent. Look forward to it.
So, yeah, should be good. So am I starting?
Yep, you go first.
Okay, John. Now, you know, because we've talked about this particular thing a long time, before it was even created. And I still think in years to come, we're going to find out that there were a lot of, how should I put it? A lot of things behind the scenes that went on that maybe not quite as carried out the way they should have been. And I'm talking about Optus Stadium. Now, Optus Stadium here is our, if you're overseas, is our new, as they keep calling it, state-of-the-art, although it's 7 years old now, so I'm saying, not sure it's now state-of-the-art, but anyway, stadium, and it's meant to have been a multi-purpose stadium, but realistically, it is predominantly for Australian rules football and cricket. I think it's a very poor venue to watch rectangular sports. Now, the government spent on this stadium, the final figure was $1.8 billion. Now, when the price came out originally at $1.6 billion, we were all told that every household had contributed $1,500. That's every household in Western Australia. That was what their taxpayer money had gone towards, right? Which, I don't know. At the end of the day, I don't have a problem because it is a good event venue and whatever. But once it's built, I would expect that our taxpayer money wouldn't be being used for it to host events. Like, to me, why are we paying money for concerts? Why are we paying for football teams to come and play at this stadium? Surely that defies the whole object of building it in the first place, because we were told if we build it, they will come.
Yes.
And it's not happened. And I mean, it just, I don't know. I'm just like going, when is it going to be self-sufficient and we're not going to keep seeing the government putting money in to underwrite these events? Now, just to give you some stats, John, because this is, I think, quite interesting. They put this out about a month or so ago, announcing that it opened its gates 6 years ago, which was on the 21st of January, 2018. In those 6 years, they've hosted 254 major events, and 8 million fans have entered the venue. You think, that sounds all right. But it equates to an average of 31,496 people per event. Now, this is a venue where the capacity for just a regular capacity is 61,266. If it's a rectangular pitch, it's 65,000. And if it's a concert, it's 70,000.
Hang on. So I thought it was 40,000.
No, it's 61,000.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then that means that the average capacity being utilized is only 51% over those 254 major events. Now, that to me is terrible. If you were a hotel, you know, hotels look to operate at 80, 90% to turn money. So what do you need to get your capacities in this stadium to turn money? I'm sure at 50%, you are not going to be breaking even.
Well, of course, it's stadium management, isn't it? So there's a lot to be taken into account, considering catering and...
But this is, again, we've got a government security department that is running the stadium. Now, that, again, I think is where the problem lies. If we had given the lease to an independent company, I think you would see a very different figures being produced.
Do you not think that a private company would still stick their hand out for all the government?
Oh, of course, I think they would, but I just think you would have better figures than this personally, because they are specialists in what they do. I don't have a lot of faith in Venues West, it's Venues Live that run Optus, but everyone I've spoken to has been pretty disparaging about them as an event management company.
I just worried that these are events and organisations that are held to make a profit. Coldplay didn't come here out of the goodness of their own heart to do it for nothing.
Nah.
Okay? Their intention is to make money. Why are we subsidising their intention to make money?
Yeah.
That's all good. I've got nothing against Coldplay doing that per se. But why would you do that? Why would we give taxpayers money so other people can make money like that?
Yeah, I mean, the one that gets
me... He's not even a resident. Chris Martin.
But also, you look, they've just announced that they're going to bring AC Milan and AS Roma coming here to play at Optus Stadium on the 31st of May. Now, not two of the biggest Italian clubs, if you were looking at them. Okay, AC Milan is, but yeah, they're not... Yeah, they're okay, but... I mean, the thing that I find is, what timing? So this season's only finishing in May, so they're really going to be enthusiastic coming to Australia to play another game after the season's over.
You're the CEO of Milan. Boys, got some news for you. Look, at the end of the season, we've decided we're going to treat you blokes. We're going to take you to Perth, and we're going to get on the juice.
Yeah, and you just got to play one game.
One game. We'll go and see the Black Swans.
Yeah, but
and the Quokkas. Don't forget the Quokkas. We'll be seeing them too.
Oh, there'll probably be some selfies of those. But I don't think you're going to fill the stadium with people buying tickets to that game. I'm sorry, I just don't think it will happen, because neither of those teams are the big teams at the moment or the big name teams. I don't think the Italian community now will support that as much as they did. And I remember going to watch Western Australia, it was Perth Glory play Sampdoria in, was it 1995, just before the Glory started? And Sven-Göran Eriksson was involved in that. And I mean, there wasn't a huge crowd at the Wacker for that game. So I'm just wondering, is it going to change now? But just before we
you'll probably be able to get a park in Fremantle or North Perth.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll get a table at a lot of the coffee shops.
Yeah.
But here's another one, John, that I find interesting about this whole thing. So as I said there, the capacity for a concert. Now, this is being taken from, you know, Optus's site. 70,000, right? Ed Sheeran, when he played here on the 12th of March 2023, record attendance at the venue, 73,092. And you're going, how can that be higher than the capacity?
That's interesting. Don't know.
I just wonder whether the fire brigade or the health and safety were aware that there were 3,092 people over the limit.
Well... what happens if you are? I mean, what are other consequences if you do that?
Yeah, like I don't know. I mean, years ago, it never mattered. I mean, I remember going to watch football in England, and you went through the turnstiles, and of course, when you were a kid, they'd always go, "Oh, it's jammed. Just jump over it." So they took the money, we jumped over it, and I mean, there were always more than what they claimed. You know, oh, it's a bit like the A-League, isn't it? There's always less than they claim in there.
Yeah. Oh, look, Optus Stadium, I'm waiting for we need a bigger stadium so Taylor Swift will play here. She would only play at stadiums that held so many thousand, and we don't have a stadium that can have Taylor Swift play here. That'll be the next big call. It's not far away.
But the other thing, John...
It's not big enough.
But the other thing I look at with this, I mean, it's now been open for 6 years. They've done really nothing in that precinct area. Now, I just thought there would be...
They built a pub.
Yeah, I know. But I would have thought there would have been so much more. Like, I was expecting a Western Australian sports museum. Like, the museum at the MCG is a fantastic sports museum. Why couldn't we have created something along the lines of that? Because, again, Western Australia has a lot of sporting history here. We've produced some amazing world champions in a number of sports. And it would have been great to have had a venue where...
when statues?
Around the outside. You could do that as well. Yeah, or even a walk of fame.
Yeah.
You know, where everybody that's, say, from Western Australia that's in, you know, I don't know. Like, I always suggested to the Wacker, and this was a while back, that years ago at Centurion in the old Wanderers in South Africa, that if you scored 100 at the Wanderers Ground, you planted a tree. Now, you think, how cool would that be if you did that? So then you have this avenue of trees that you walk along, and when you're going years to come with your grandson, you go, do you know what? I remember I was there on that day when he did that. And I just think it's just makes the whole experience so good. And I mean, someone said, what would you do for bowlers? And I said, well, you could plant a rose bush or something like that. The same thing. They could have a tree if they get a fiver as well. It doesn't matter, you know, but I just think if you just do things like that, they're a small gesture, but they in over the length of time, they mean so much more.
I think the problem you face is that no sport actually sort of owns it.
Yeah.
You know, like the Wanderers is essentially a cricket
game. Yeah, I understand that. So, but you could have had a walk of fame of all, you know, athletes that have been world champions from Western Australia.
You come over the bridge
and
you're walking along up to the stadium and on either side is statues or trees with plaques or whatever it happens to be. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and we've had enough world champions from here.
I think you're right about the precinct isn't that great. I mean, it's more than a hefty walk from the Burswood complex.
Yep.
Okay, they've got a pub there, a big pub, but it's a pub.
Yep.
And that's what it is, fine. But there's nothing really else. There's a big oval out the back, a few park benches.
Yep.
Maybe they could stick some of those council barbecues in. You know, the ones that...
Yep.
Something like
that. Would
that.
Be a great idea, actually. So people could have a braai or, like, the South African rugby fans would be there in hordes before the game.
You know, what do they call it in America? It's not tailgating.
Yeah, it is. I know. They do the same thing in South Africa. Yeah.
Yeah, where before the NFL games or whatever, people pull up in the car parks hours early, have their barbecues out. Maybe something like that could be a nice tradition. I don't know. Maybe the authorities will just... worried about Australians having a barbecue at 10 o'clock in the morning for a 4 o'clock game or something. Could be an issue.
But I like your idea there of the benches. I mean, you imagine if you had a bench, and I'm just using him as an example because, you know, he won a Cricket World Cup, Justin Langer, could be sitting as a statue on one of the benches on the way there. So you could have Justin Langer on one bench, you know. You could have Betty Cuthbert on another one. She was from here, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there you go.
No,
she
was at Eastern State.
Oh, yeah, she was. Well, let's say Margaret Court then.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, but she's West Australian.
She is. Might be a bit of opposition to that one, but
there might
sadly,
be, but
I'd put her up.
Hey, look, I'm judging her as an athlete. I don't care about anything else.
That's all. How about we could have seats with a statue of individual householders who paid for the stadium. And you can sit down and on your seat. Oh, look, this is me when I paid $1,500 for the stadium.
Yeah, and then how much have I contributed to all these other things?
It's interesting the way they break it down into household, though.
Yeah.
Because a household can have one person living in it or could have 10 people living in it.
Yeah, exactly.
So are you saying I paid 10 times more than the house with...
You're living on your own, I think you did.
Yeah.
This is Gary Lineker, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we have a very special guest lined up for you. He's been on the show before, and I'm pleased to welcome him back. And the reason I wanted to have a chat with him is because Perth Glory, which was such a strong club in the old National Soccer League, has gone through a really tough time, I hate to say, under the stewardship of Tony Sage. There's been a number of scandals. The fans have left in droves. And so the new owners, the Peligra Group and Ross Peligra, have got a pretty big job to try and turn that around. And I thought it would just be interesting to catch up with a man who knows how to do this stuff, how to make a brand soar. So we've got David Mitchell back, who is a brand consultant. David Mitchell, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you for having me back, Ashley.
Well, it's been quite a while since we caught up, but I know that obviously you're a brand consultant and that's what you do for a living. You make sure people sort out their brands. Well, over here in Western Australia, I know I've had a bit of a brief chat with you about it, but Perth Glory is our football team in the national competition. It was very successful in the old competition, struggled really since we went to the A-League and full-time professionalism. And then it's kind of the crowds have dropped, the ownership, there was a bit of controversy. We've got new owners who've just taken it over, but it's going to be a lot of work, I think, for them to re-engage the public. I mean, I know you've looked into it a little bit. How does one re-engage the public when, say, a club has lost support?
So I think there's a number of things you need to do. And I've had a look at the deal that has been done and some of the PR that's coming out. And Ross Peligra, as I think his name. Yeah, he's bought it. I think the thing that's encouraging when I look at that is that he's not coming into football as a bit of a whim and I've never done sports before. This is a guy that's owned other teams and has been through the mill in terms of owning a team and running a team. And he's got in basketball and he's got another football team in Italy. So he's got sports sort of in his veins. And I think that's a really good sign for Perth Glory that you've got somebody coming in who's owning it, who gets sport. And I think you need to look at some of the other examples of where teams have been bought by other people. I think that one of the biggest stories recently was Sir Jim Ratcliffe buying Manchester United, or 25% of Manchester United and taking control of that sport. Now he's a businessman. He's probably one of the richest people in the UK, but he's cut his teeth on, owning, he took over the Sky Cycling team. It's now the Ineos Grenadiers. He owns third of the Mercedes Formula One team. He's got the Ineos Britannia America's Cup team. So he knows, and he's got a couple of football teams as well, one in France and one he's got Nice in France and I think it's Lausanne in Switzerland. So he knows sports. He's got his organization understands what it requires to turn a team around. And I therefore think he'll do really well at Manchester United. So when you look at what Ross is going to do with Perth Glory, he's got that experience. And I think that's a really good first step. You haven't got somebody in who's just going to pick it up as a toy and play with it for a couple of weeks and then go, I'm not really sure I want to do this. He's making commitments. I think the second thing that's really interesting is that he has a vision. And I think you've got to come into something like this with a vision for what you want to do. The fans are sitting there going, we've had a really rough time. The team isn't performing. We're seeing, you know, players being sold off. There's no one really in charge and you've got somebody coming in who's got experience, but who's also got a vision. And he's clearly articulated that. He's said the three things he needs to do are reconnect, drive success and long-term sustainability. And I think, you know, that's right. He's going to come in and reconnect. He's going to understand what the fans want. He's going to try and understand the history of the club and the heritage of the club, and start to get people on side. Driving success, you've got to have success in the team. If you don't have success, then fans aren't going to follow it as much as they will. And it's got to be long term. If you're going to build the brand back and get Perth Glory back to being a really strong brand, the two things you need to do in branding are have a long term vision. It takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. You've got to change it slowly. And it's got to be sustainable. There's got to be a strong financial footing under it. You've got to invest, whether that's in players, whether that's in facilities, whether that's in engaging with the fans. You've got to you've got to move it forward. And I thought that, you know, his mind's in the right place. He's talking about listening. He's listening to fans. And I think the first thing he did was, the first match that he was in charge, he announced that, kids could go for free. Under 16s, the first 3,000 under 16s to turn up could get in for free. Now that to me is somebody who's sort of going, actually fans are really important. And you know, he said, make sure it's got ownership of the local people. You know, you get the fans in that way. So I think there's lots of things that the signs of what he's doing in the first couple of weeks of him being there are really good.
You mentioned success, and we know that sports fans are very impatient when it comes to success. They want it every season, but the realism is that that's not going to actually happen. But how important is it, as long as they can see a team that is getting better and is building? So like you said, that long-term sustainability, and they can see that the team's improving. If those two are happening side by side, is that, do you think, something that will bring people back?
I think it will. I think there's success is key, and fans, you know, love success. However, if you have a team which has a strong brand that's engaging with its fans, you can also have a team that isn't winning every time because people are following it because they love the team, and they'll take the good with the bad. You know, so that they're there for the long term. They're there for the journey. They're not just there for the hit of getting a win on a Saturday afternoon. So having strength in your brand as a team gives you that sort of buffer, around your results. But yes, obviously people want to see progression. I think another really interesting example of this is Wrexham Football Club in the UK. So, they were a sort of a mid-tier team floundering around, not doing very much. And then suddenly, it gets a bit of Hollywood glitz, with Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney coming in and, buying the team. And that put the spotlight onto it. They've done exactly what, Ross is talking about doing at Perth Glory, which is connected with the audience, with the fans. They've had this TV show that's followed the progress of the team. They've invested in players. They've started to see the results coming through. They're near the top of their league, although they did dropped to third place, I think, in the last match and got booed off the pitch because of that. So the fans wanted to express their displeasure at losing the game. But you know, they are showing that success can come, although it's taking time. And overnight,
they're spending a lot of money on that team by comparison to other teams in that division. You know, so money.
They're spending a lot of money. Yeah.
Yeah.
Money pays, you know, money. And I think also you know, by having they built the brand around them and Wrexham, you know, the sponsors are coming in, the gates are going up. So the money is flowing back into the club. But success doesn't come overnight. There are so many elements within a team, that builds that winning mentality. And that takes time to build. It's cultural change.
We've talked about this in the past, and I know, to me, if you look at a football club, yes, people want to, or as any sporting club, people want to be associated with success, but also there's a bit more to it that I think that there's also, especially probably in football, where people want a connection with that team if it's representing where they live. And also there's almost like the values attached to the club. They want them to be values that they buy into as well. Do you agree with that, or am I being a little bit sort of just, I don't know, soapboxy?
No, I think there is an element of that. I think when you look at what makes up a brand of a team, there's that sort of core identity at the heart of it, that thought that you want people to have about the club. There's a set of values that the club has. Now, those can be ones that have been long-standing, but as times change and society changes, those may need to be updated over time, to reflect the more modern society. But there's also the heritage. The heritage plays a huge part in the story of the club and people's connection to the local area. So, you know, all of those things need to align. And then once you've got that as a club, you've got to deliver that clarity through everything you do. You've got to be very clear what you stand for. You can't be one thing one week and one thing another week. And then, like any brand, whether it's a commercial brand or a sporting brand, you've got to deliver those values and that brand with ruthless consistency. Everything you do needs to fall back to that one sort of model that you've created. And if you start to be inconsistent, you look unfocused, and the moment you look unfocused, people lose interest.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things as well, I mean, it used to be over here that the Perth Glory, when they were playing, there used to be an 8-page lift out in the newspaper on a Monday on football. Now they're lucky if they get, you know, 15 column inches in the paper. But so is that when that all starts to happen, the things that you're talking about, do you think then the media will buy in themselves because they'll see the momentum that's happening and they'll want to get back on board because hopefully we'll pull in subscribers or readers to what they're doing?
Well, I think one of the things is who reads newspapers these days? You know, so it's a lot of the engagement that the club is going to be doing is going to be directly through social media. So having a really strong social media organization behind what you're doing, that's engaging, that's keeping people informed, that's amusing, that's really important. I spent the last 9 years working with the Mercedes Formula One team. And, you know, behind the scenes there, back in 2014 when we started, I think the team had a million followers on social media and one person doing the occasional posts. You look at it today and, you know, it's in tens of millions of people following on social media and a whole team of people creating engaging and interesting content to keep fans up to date with what's happening and amused and challenged and educated. So I think the traditional media role in building a brand, you know, has lessened over the years, and social media has really become something that sports teams and sports individuals, you know, have to embrace.
I think the key thing there, though, as you said, is you've got to invest in that. And we do see over here so many organizations where they've got one or two people trying to do this and also trying to engage with people of different age groups. And I mean, for example, there's some of the stuff that gets churned out. I find it quite childish and it annoys me because I'm thinking, look, I already know all this, but they've got to engage with those as well.
Yeah. And that's again, with any organization, any marketing organization, you have your audience. You know, you know the people within that audience, but there are going to be segments within that audience that you want to engage in different ways. So knowing your audience, understanding who they are, understanding what they want, is really important in the way you start to deliver your messages. And that's whether you're a sports team or a corporate brand. If unless you understand your audience, you can't put on a performance that they're going to enjoy.
Yeah. So the key thing really looking ahead for Ross Pellegra is that he's got to understand what his audience wants, and then he's got to invest and basically try and deliver that to them via the various platforms and on the pitch as well.
There's that. I think there's also, you know, you've got a clear vision of where it's going, engaging with the external audience. But I think there's also the internal audience. So building a culture within the team, which is a high performance culture. So, you know, making sure that you get rid of the, you know, you get rid of politics is one thing. So that, you know, you've got everybody working towards the same direction. Getting rid of blame. There's so much finger pointing going on in organizations. It's your fault. They didn't do this. Getting rid of that so that you're addressing an issue, not the problem, not the person. You're getting to the core of what's holding you back and solving those and moving forward as a group rather than as a set of individuals all fighting for your own territory. So I think he's, you know, that's another area that an owner needs to come in and really get to grips with, is that internal culture. And quite often fans don't see very much of that. They'll hear bits of it, but, you know, once you're inside the team, if you're in a high performing team where everybody's pulling in the same direction, it's an incredible feeling. And once you start to win, it just multiplies that feeling and you start to believe that you can't lose. And that's a powerful position to be in. That's another challenge for him.
Now, it sure is. I'm just thinking, you touched on the fact that you worked in F1. There's a bit of that going on at the moment, isn't there, in the F1, as to finger pointing as to who's leaked things and who's done what?
Yes, I think you're referring to the situation with Red Bull and the complaint against Christian Horner for misdoings. Yeah, I mean there's if you watch that, there's a team ripping itself apart at the moment. There's a global brand that's 51% owned by a Thai family and 49% owned by an Austrian organisation, with a Formula One team underneath it and a leader who's, you know, allegedly been behaving inappropriately, and it's causing you know, I think embarrassment for the for not only the Red Bull brand but for the sport as well, because it's overshadowing what's going on the track, and that's that feels like a shame. And it although they're trying to calm it all down at the moment, I don't think it's over by a long stretch yet. So watch this space as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, no, I mean it's I agree with you. I think it's very sad because it's detracting from the sport, and you know you've got Max Verstappen looking to again achieve sort of 10 consecutive victories coming up, and we should be talking about that again, and the miraculous fact that he's doing it again, you know.
Yeah, and all credit to Red Bull on the track. You know, they are performing, you know, incredibly well. And I find that very hard to criticize, having worked with Mercedes for 9 years, where we won 8 consecutive world championships. And, you know, we were sitting there watching, you know, watching our cars win all the time. And why can't anybody catch us up? And let's hope they don't. And that's where Red Bull, we're in a Red Bull era at the moment, and all credit to them for interpreting the rules as they are today and coming up with an incredibly fast car. And Max is a sort of a robot in terms of the way he drives it. You know, it's impressive to watch. And the challenge is for everybody else in the sport to catch up and beat them. And there's some incredibly close racing going on behind. It's interesting if you're a sponsor of Red Bull at the moment, you'd be going, well, my cars never get seen on TV, because actually the TV coverage is going on in the second, third, fourth, fifth battles. Whereas, you know, you might see Max occasionally, oh yeah, he's still there. He's still winning the race. Oh, we're back to what's happening further back in the field. So the exposure sponsors are getting on a Red Bull car is probably less than Ferraris and, Mercedes and anybody else who's in that front pack.
There you go. That's something I must admit I hadn't thought about. And now you mention it, I'm thinking, yeah, you've got to be right with that. It would be the case, wouldn't it? I mean, that must be extremely frustrating. And I'm sure the sponsor would want something back, wouldn't they? Some form of compensation?
Well, I think that the sponsorship agreements are fairly clear that that you can't determine how much TV coverage you get, because that's at the whim of the race director. But the race director is obviously there to entertain, and he will want to be showing that the overtakes and the battles wherever they occur. Now, if you happen to be having somebody, you know, going for a 1-2 sort of battle, great, you get lots of coverage. But if your car is 10 seconds in front of everybody else and running away with the race, don't expect to get covered.
No, absolutely. Something I hadn't thought about. But it's funny because I remember actually talking to someone about this years ago, and it was about rugby sponsorship. And I was sort of going, why would you want your name on the front of the shirt when most of the time their hands are in front of the shirt, blocking the view of that? And I thought that a sponsorship on the sort of back of the shorts would be more beneficial. But then when I was shown the figures, you do actually see the logo on the front far more than you do one on the shorts. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and you know, you can dig into the data. I've looked at the Formula One data over 9 years in a lot of detail. And you can see exactly where, you could get reports which tell you exactly which logos get seen for how much time, or where, on which parts of the uniforms and, which parts of the car. And, you know, with Formula One, if you're a title sponsor and you're on a team that's winning, you are doing really well, because you're not only getting, a lot of coverage of the team in the garage, you're getting a lot of coverage of the car. And then you're getting podium coverage, and podium coverage when you've won, if you're on the front of the race suit, that really, really boosts your exposure. So it's worth having that. I think the other thing as well, when talking to companies about sponsorship, you know, the really big bucks are for the title sponsors. And you've got to go, well, what's the payback on that? Well, the payback on that is that every other sponsor, whenever they use any imagery of the car, they're giving you exposure. So the multiplication effect of being a title sponsor is that your brand is going into everybody else's marketing material right across the world. However they're activating the sport, your brand will always be there. So it's not just what you do and what's on the TV, but it's that multiplication effect of being in all the other sponsors' marketing activities.
Fantastic to catch up, but I know I will be shot by John, my co-host, if I don't ask you this while we've actually got you on the show, because a bit of a bee in his bonnet is the fact that our national teams are now, we're seeing them with naming rights sponsors. So we have the national soccer team is, or a football team is the Subway Socceroos. Now, there's a lot of us feel that a national team should just be a national team and not have a brand in front of it. I mean, what's your view on that? Do you think that's a risky thing to do for the national team, or is it a really smart bit of marketing by the brand that gets attached to it?
That's an interesting question. Let me think about it. I think from a commercial perspective, it's probably really good for the national team. It brings in money. From a sponsor's perspective, they get the kudos for being part of the national team. From a fan's perspective, they probably don't even think about it. They're probably just going, you know, you when you're talking to your friends, you don't talk about the Subway Socceroos. You just talk about the Socceroos. So it's there as an awareness thing, but it's not, you know, you're not engaging with it particularly well. And you're not using it like that. So it's a commercial deal. It is what it is. It's bringing in money. It's probably giving a, you know, your, you know, the governing body, the people who run it, a bit more money in their pay packet every month. And, you know, giving them the opportunity to pay for travel and whatever else. But, you know, it's not going to affect fans particularly. You know, you can get annoyed by it if you like, but I wouldn't worry too much.
We get annoyed about it because it's an American company in front of an Australian brand, and you sort of think, no, we don't like that very much. But anyway.
And that's probably a good reason to do that. You know, it's a shame maybe that there were no Australian companies who either were given the opportunity or felt, you know, the need to do that. And that would probably make more sense from a branding perspective. I think when we, you know, where sponsorships really work well is where fans can see that it makes sense for this sporting organization, that commercial organization, to be working together and bringing things to life. When it's forced together, you know, you're getting the result, the reaction that you're going, which is like, oh, you know, I'm not sure why it's working. It doesn't look genuine. But if it had it been an Australian company and, you know, something that's flying the flag for Australia across the world, you'd probably go, yeah, it makes sense.
No.
So, yeah, it does feel a little bit forced, but you know, that's what happens in the commercial world of sponsorship these days.
Well, David, it's been brilliant catching up with you again. Thanks very much for sharing your views, and it sounds like we're on the right track anyway with the Perth Glory.
Yeah, I shall keep an eye on it from now on.
Thanks again for your time.
Hi, I'm Thomas the Hitman Hunt. And you are listening to Not the Foodie Show.
And that was David Mitchell, a brand consultant. And hopefully you found that really interesting. Not just talking about the Perth Glory, but also our little segue into F1. And it was very interesting, John, to see what he had to say about how the Red Bull image at the moment is getting tarnished by all that's going on within the Red Bull team. And that's the Red Bull, the drink, is getting damaged as well because of its association.
I thought taste would have been enough to damage yeah. Red Bull, but, you know, that's just...
I have to say I'm not a fan either.
No. Yeah, interesting. Interesting comments.
And I did get the question in for you about your favourite pet hate, the Subway Socceroos.
Oh, well, you know, I get that the whole thing is a financial stuff. It's just a pity that national teams can't raise enough money to not have to worry, but you know, they haven't got other avenues to do that.
No, absolutely. But I think it was very interesting, and I mean, hopefully Glory fans will find that a really positive spin coming from David, and let's hope he's right, because it would be great to see a club here again get back to where it was.
Oh yeah, it's sport. Swings and roundabouts. No one stays on top forever.
Yeah, but this roundabout was going very fast and threw everybody off.
Well, yeah, true.
You're not allowed roundabouts now, are you? Because they're dangerous. I think kids fall off them.
Yeah, think of it more like a wave, sine wave. So you get your peaks and your troughs. The idea is to minimise the difference between your peaks and try and keep the peaks high.
Yeah, and the troughs not so low.
Yes.
Anyway.
Or is extended.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm having problems with my microphone here.
Yeah, there is a little bit of popping. We apologise for that. There's just been a few technical issues this end.
I had to reach for the old SM57 instrument microphone, so it's a little bit touchy. My turn?
Yep.
Because I got some bullet points here, Ashley.
Okay.
I got some bullet points. Let's start with rugby league in Vegas. Now, you mentioned before AC Milan coming here with, who was the other team?
Roma, yep.
And it being a nothing game. Hats off to the NRL for taking a live games to Vegas. They weren't just exhibition games. They were live games with something on the line for the teams involved. So they were pretty keen about it. It wasn't just a trip to Vegas for the boys. After it, in the wash-up, I was listening to some commentary on the NRL Cheerleaders Channel 9, and congratulations to Channel 9 for being such strong supporters of rugby league over many, many years. So when I say cheerleaders, I'm not using it in a derogatory sense. That's part of what they do because they have to. It's as much their product as the NRL's, right? And in the wash-up, they were talking and they're having a panel discussion and chatting away. And one of the ideas that came across in this panel discussion was, you know, it was great to see so many Aussies here, and these people will go back to Australia and next year and tell everybody how great again. And next year, will even more people will be coming over here. Blah blah blah. What's the point of going to Las Vegas? So Australians can go to Las Vegas and watch rugby league. We don't have to go to Las Vegas to watch rugby league. The whole point was in getting Americans there.
To watch rugby league, yeah.
Get Americans in there. Don't worry about getting all these Australians to go over there. Why are you doing it? If it's to support the Las Vegas Tourism Board, that's the way to go about it.
Yeah, look, I think it's, I mean, if we look, American football has done it in London for a number of years. They take a game there.
Yeah.
And there was talk about the Premier League bringing a fixture to Australia, and then suddenly there was, oh, you can't do that. They must be played at home. I think if it's done properly and for the right reasons, there's a lot of merit in what you're doing. And I mean, rugby league, as you said there, I used to not really watch rugby league in the UK. I was more of a rugby union man. But, you know, Eddie Waring was one of the great commentators of that sport. But when I came to Australia, it was like, wow, rugby league was such a different game when I came to Australia. It was packaged superbly.
Yep.
It was marketed superbly. And the physicality just seemed to be so much more brutal than I was used to watching it in the UK. I think it's evolved now in the UK because we've seen a lot more Australians going over there and playing and coaching. But I think it's a really good move. And I mean, the rugby league, as I say, I just think they do things very, very well. Yes, they have their problems with players off the pitch. Name a sport that doesn't. Let's be honest. Every sport now is reliant on their players doing the right thing. But to me, rugby league taking it to the world, they need to grow the game because their Rugby World Cup, with all due respect, is a bit of a joke. Is, you know, there's not many people that are actually challenging in it.
Three, essentially.
Yeah.
Australia, New Zealand and England. But there's other nations catching up. And of all the sports that are trying to break into America that aren't traditionally American sports, I would think rugby league's right up there with the best chance. A, the size of the fields work for them. It's not too dissimilar to what American football is.
Yeah, and they're not wearing the padding like they do.
They're not wearing the padding. It's easier to understand for a spectator than rugby union, for example.
100% agree with you there.
It's
especially rugby league, rugby union rules now.
Yeah. You know, one of the problems football faces is that there's not the ovals to play it on. Australian rules football, I should say. So they're going to have a hard time pushing into that market, full stop. It's almost like rugby league is set up. If there's going to be a sport break into the US, it's going to be that game.
And I think you mentioned of the other rugby, because Sevens has done well in America because it's short, it's fast, and let's be fair, America produces a lot of explosive athletes, so it really suits them.
There's no scrums or
Well, there are, but there's only three players, but it's quick and the ball is given to these speed machines that can run, and Americans like that, and they're used to seeing that in the NFL.
Yeah.
So I think that's why Sevens has worked, and I can see this is why rugby league would work. I think you're absolutely right.
Okay, next point.
Yep.
It's back.
What is?
The pool of death.
Oh, your favorite thing. That I think you're talking about the Olympics, aren't you?
The Olympics. The schedule for the women's football at the Olympics has been released. And once again, the poor little minnow nation Australia is up against it. Despite coming fourth at the recent World Cup, we're up against such powerhouses as the US and Germany in our pool. Where did they finish at the World Cup, Ashley?
Yeah, they didn't make it through to the semi-finals.
Will Australian sports journalists please stop this? Please. It's Germany and America that should be looking at their pool and going, oh, my God, we've got Australia. Not the other way around.
They may well be doing that, but Australia likes to be the underdog, doesn't it?
It's almost like they're preempting if it doesn't go right.
Yeah.
Oh, we were in the pool of death. You finished fourth less than 12 months ago at a World Cup. You are one of the teams that would be listed in the don't play in their pool list. Remember the last Women's World Cup? Australia was in the top bracket. You know how I'm sure our listeners know how they put it up in brackets. You know, you got your six top teams and then the next six and next six, and each pool is made up by one team from each bracket. Australia was in the top bracket, and they were calling that the pool of death.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is...
Stop it, Australian sports media.
I think, though, John, in the world rankings in FIFA, I think you'll find that the USA and Germany are still ranked 1 and 2. So that is probably why people could argue against you and say, you know, that's why it is the pool of death. But, I don't know. I think you need to sort of change your view on that slightly.
How many games have America played since they came nearly last at the last World Cup?
I wouldn't know is the answer to that.
I reckon it wouldn't be that many.
No, it wouldn't, but they did play, I think, Olympic qualifiers. Okay. So, yeah, they did play those, but they'll be fired up after that World Cup. And they still feel, that the penalty that they were denied and they went out on crossed the line. And I've spoken to somebody who was involved in the broadcast and they said they thought it crossed the line. So, interesting. When I was watching it, I never got to see that angle live. We just got the computer graphic saying that it didn't.
Wait and see.
Yeah.
Hey, but let's face it, when you go to the Olympics in a team sport and whatever other sport, whatever it is, the whole competition is the pool of death.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the point of going to these competitions.
But this is where in some sports now, John, I would rather have the best teams in the world, and I know we've said this before, than having a team from every confederation or every part of the world. To me, if you're going to have these top events, and I understand there's TV rights and you've got to encourage these other countries, but to me, I'd rather just say, okay, let's just have the best in the world. So if you look at the 1988 Hockey Women's Olympics, and I've just written a book which is with publishers at the moment, it was the top 8 teams. They were the only ones that competed. It was you're ranked 1 to 8 in the world, you go. And if you look at other events, like we had, you know, Ben Wright, the power weightlifter on, and he was saying, you know, he has to be in that top 8 to qualify for the Olympics. So you go, when we go to confederations, I don't know. It's, look, that's my view. I'd just rather see the best of the best.
Fair enough. Moving on. Remember a couple of weeks ago we had Niall Cooper on from Fair Game UK talking about regulation?
Yeah.
Well, in the last week or so, there's been reports coming out of the UK of the government actually wanting to do that.
Yeah, the Football Governance Act has gone, it got approved, yeah.
So the government now regulates football in the UK.
Yep, and the ownership and the owners are going to be under a bit of scrutiny now, which is fantastic news for all fans.
Does that mean that there's going to be wage restrictions, minimum wages? Does that mean a whole host of other things that governments have the power to do will now be enacted within the sport in that country? Will they have the power to say, no, you're not getting £100 million a year. That's outrageous and stupid.
Well, I don't think they'll be saying it quite like that, but if you read the reports that have come out and if you think back to when we spoke to Niall, what they were saying is they want to tighten up the financial reporting. So I think from memory when we did the interview, and it's 2 podcasts ago if people want to listen, he was saying, I think out of the 92 clubs, and I might get this number slightly wrong because I'm going from memory, I think he said of the 92 clubs in the football, Premier League and the Football League, there were 77 different ways of reporting your accounts. So I think what they're going to do is they're going to make it that you have to report your accounts the same way every single club. So that is going to make it harder for people to hide how they're paying players under the table or how they're moving money around and maybe using it for other purposes, etc. So that's going to be a good thing. So I think you will see that happen, John, but I don't think it's – I certainly know that they're looking to try and bring in a salary cap, certainly outside of the Premier League. And if they start by doing it there, then it may eventually – because, you know, at the end of the day, if clubs are losing money and they're going to have to tighten their belts. So I think you're going to see more fiscal responsibility, which I believe in time will lead to those wages coming down. Yes.
I mean, in some sense, we already have that situation going with organisations like the Australian Sports Commission and things like that. There are already other sports that are being effectively run by government. Yeah, you might say, oh, well, we've got our independent Australia board and all that sort of stuff. But most of your funding comes through the Australian Sports Commission or the Australian Olympic Committee, which are intrinsically tied together.
Yeah, over here, definitely. Yeah, I mean, now, I think the problem with, if you look at football in the UK, was sadly the people running the game were dumb. That's the only way to put it. And then they became too
greedy. That's well, the word you're looking for. Yeah,
it is greedy, but I also think those that were in the administration then became controlled by the owners of the clubs. So they kowtowed and bowed down to the demands of the owners, whereas they should have stood firm and said, no, we're protecting the future of football rather than your club. We need to do this for the good of the game. And I think some of them were heavily influenced by owners of clubs.
Who does the buck stop with? I.e., if you look at American sport, the NFL, they've got a commissioner.
Yep.
And the buck stops with the commissioner. A lot of their sports have a board of owners or whatever, but there's a commissioner appointed, and that's where the buck stops.
And
where
he has a lot of power, or she has a lot of power.
Mate, what they say happens, and that's it.
And I think that is part of the problem that you would have with a lot of sports in Britain or even here, is that the CEO doesn't have as much power. In a lot of cases with sports here in Australia, I'm very pleased the CEO doesn't have that amount of power, because I don't think the caliber of our CEOs is great.
Fair enough. One more?
If you want, you're on a roll at the moment.
One more.
I mean, like, crikey.
Olympics.
Actually, now we've gone on a bit long, but anyway, yeah.
Just quickly, Olympics, we've had our say over the years about the Olympic movement and where it's heading and where it's been and what the future may hold. Do you think there will be an Olympics in Brisbane?
No.
Okay, that's on the record now? We've got it
on
the record?
Yeah, I've been saying that for a long time.
I am staggered that...
I think they were pressured into it in the first place, and I'm not sure that they really did this sums.
It reminds me of the Australian involvement in the Pro League. You don't have to worry about doing any of that stuff. I'll put your name up. You'll be fine. You'll get in. Don't worry about doing financial due diligence and that sort of stuff. How could you make a bid on an Olympic Games and not have some sort of plan about where they were going to be held and who was going to pay for it?
But this goes back, and we've said it before, the only reason they had to pencil in somebody for 2032 was because the TV rights deal expires in 2032, and the TV broadcast, I think it's NBC, is it, in America, that had signed the deal. It might be CBS, I can't remember. But they were going, well, what's going on? Like, because we've signed to 2032, we want to know that you're still there, or you're not going to get all of our money.
Oh.
So suddenly the IOC were like, we need to find a host city. And, of course, the vice president of the IOC went, oh, I've got an answer for that.
Yes, of course he did. Who's now up there again telling people what they should and shouldn't do as far as how the Olympics should be run there, what venues they should and shouldn't use.
Look, I think the Olympics is in a lot of trouble. personally. I think the TV rights have got too expensive. There are some countries now that are just saying they're not buying it this time around, which is a big blow to fans in those countries. But what I think, it's just got too big, too cumbersome. They need to trim it right back. And the Olympic medals now aren't worth what they were. And by that, what I mean is when there were so few of them in a certain sport. Take swimming, as we've used as an example. When Dawn Fraser won, there were only 11 medals between the men and the women. 6 in the men's, 5 in the women's. Now there's 54.
Yeah, it's a lot of events, isn't it, to get through.
So you devalue the medal, I'm sorry.
The big argument in Brisbane at the moment seems to be legacy.
Oh, you know, it's a buzzword, about, it's like legend.
Yeah. Oh, we've got to make sure there's...
Well, the legacy from the Women's FIFA World Cup, we were told that the FA had made all this money, but then as soon as it was over, they were back out again, going to the government for more money. They want to host the Women's Asia Cup, and what are they doing again? They're going to the government for money. Well, what about all the money you just made?
Oh, no. Well, that's for Sam Kerr's legal fees, isn't it?
Ooh.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.